Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday Interview Edition, here from Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. Had another great talk today, everybody, with Sean Gunn. Met Sean, I think I teased this out a few weeks ago. I met Sean at a wedding a couple of weeks ago in Santa Barbara, California, to a mutual friend. I believe his fiance is friends with my friend who was getting married. Sean came along, and he was seated at my table at dinner, and he is a very cool, great guy. And it was a lot of fun to talk to out there in California. So I got his contact information. He actually owns a home here in Atlanta because he was shooting so much here. A few actors are doing that now. They're buying places here in Atlanta, which is pretty smart. So he obviously was working on in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which shoots here in Atlanta a lot. So he was on Guardians 1 and 2. And you've seen his work in the Gilmore Girls, ladies. He was on that show. We talked about that today. He was on that show for 7 years, which is kind of great. And then again with the relaunch of it a couple of years ago. And he picked the movie California Split, the great, great classic Robert Altman film from 1974 that I had never seen. This is one that got by me, so I was able to watch it this morning, as did he. And we had a really, really good talk about it. Sean is a very insightful guy, and it was fun to talk to him about not only this movie and Robert Altman, but his life growing up in a large family of siblings closely packed together in age and devouring movies and pop culture and suburban St. Louis, and then all of them somehow kind of getting involved in the entertainment industry. His brother James, obviously, the director of the Guardians movies, and his other siblings, too, have gotten involved in the film industry. So it was very cool. Good conversation about art and acting and his training in college and beyond and sort of his career path. It's always interesting to see how people got where they are, and certainly was in this case with Mr. Gunn. So here we go with Sean Gunn on California Split. My first beer podcast.
I love it.
My first drinking one. Which is kind of surprising. I had the Broken Lizard guys in here. I figured they would be drinking with me, but.
Well, probably no one else thinks that they can, you know, or.
I'm drinking at work.
Yeah, I was going to say, or people think that it will reflect poorly on them if they're like.
Oh. No, I mean, and this is like, what time is it? 4:15? Yeah. Perfect. 4:10, 5 minutes, we'll smoke some weed and it'll all be great. Here, cheers.
Yeah, slancha.
What'd you say?
Slancha.
What's that?
Gaelic.
Are you Irish?
I am.
Well, that's a good way to start talking about your background.
Great.
What's your background, Sean Gunn?
We're going now, huh?
Yeah, we're going. I'll find a good entry point.
I don't
care.
You can just start there. let's start with slancha. Let's see. My background is I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh, no way.
Suburban, you know, like deep suburbs of St. Louis. So yeah. Like, you know, half an hour outside of the city, even though I went to high school in the city. But I'm the youngest of six.
Wow.
Four brothers, one sister.
Wow.
There's less than 8 years that separates the six of us.
Oh, okay.
So we're like, bam, bam, bam.
Yeah.
In order of age.
Is that fun, growing up like that? That must have been kind of crazy.
I don't know what to compare it to.
Right. Yeah, right.
So, but I had fun. I mean, it's good. There's a lot of things, you know, it's like anything else. Like every part of it reflects on the person that I am today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up very much being sort of sheltered and babied in a way. I also had a lot of health problems as a kid, like. Had a lot of surgeries when I was super little.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of stuff? Or do you want to not talk about it?
No, I can talk. I'll say I don't want to talk about that if there's anything, but otherwise,
okay,
go for it. I had just I was the runt of the litter, basically. So I had like intestinal problems that needed to be corrected. And then mostly I was born with a pectus, which is like a caved-in chest.
Oh.
And so I had to have major reconstructive chest surgery when I was when I was about 4
wow.
years old.
Do you remember that?
I do. Uh-huh. I remember enough that I remember when I was in recovery from it for you know, many months, I had to have a T-board strapped to my back, which is was just like a big white
yeah.
T. And so it was like, and I was wrapped in it to sort of keep my chest from collapsing on itself.
Wow.
And,
man, that's harsh.
It was harsh. But you know what? I was such a weird little kid that, like, I dug it. I thought anything to make me unique
yeah.
was cool. So it was like, oh, I was, you know, that made me different.
Uh-huh.
I was, and it got me attention. And I learned later that, like, you know, I craved this. I craved attention, which I got. It's not like I
right.
wasn't getting any and I still craved it. But, like, I loved getting attention. I loved being the, you know, the center of the room. I loved, like, telling jokes
mm-hmm.
And doing little performances and things like that. And, you know, I learned later that that's just sort of part of the fabric of who I am.
Right.
You know, and it's like, it's still, I still feel it when I get, I mean, obviously I'm still a performer and I like performing in different ways now than I did when I was younger. But I still, when I get on stage in front of tons of people mm-hmm. and I'm speaking, whether it's just as myself or playing a character, no matter what it is, there's like this otherworldly rush that I get when
yeah.
I'm doing really nothing else.
Right.
You know.
And you realized that early on?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I don't know how I got from the T-board to that, but I guess, but yeah.
Was so, anyone else in your family, I mean, obviously your brother James is a writer and director. Mm-hmm. Anyone else in the film industry?
We're all in the film industry,
oh,
except
okay.
my sister. Well, in the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a really weird thing. And it's, you know, I don't know how we all sort of went that direction. I have some guesses, but, you know, my dad comes from this huge family.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of 9. He's Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
They're all, you know, lawyers and some doctors and people, you know, in the financial industry. And they're all this very sort of like old white money people.
Yeah.
And me and my 5 siblings all were way into movies and television and pop culture.
Yeah.
And we shared that with each other. We talked about it all the time. And we all ended up coming from sort of different angles. It's not like any one of us followed any of the others.
Mm-hmm.
But now James is obviously, you know, super successful. But my brother Brian is also a successful screenwriter. He's
oh,
got
right.
this movie. He and his writing partner, like, created a show for MTV and wrote Journey to the Center of the Earth 2.
Uh-huh.
And they have a movie coming out for Sony, I think, early next year. I don't know what the release date is. But this horror movie coming out, which is really cool. My brother Matt has been a writer for Real Time with Bill Maher
mm-hmm.
for over a decade.
Oh, wow. That's a steady gig.
Yeah. And he really likes it. He's kind of he was sort of the political animal in
mm-hmm.
the family, you know, most likely to be a congressperson probably, but maybe him or my sister. But still, he channeled that into entertainment,
uh-huh.
you know? So yeah, he writes, he's a writer. My brother Patrick is a business guy, but he's done it, in the film industry. He used to be, he used to work for Artisan Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
He was really involved in distribution and things like that. And now he works for a company that does like acquisitions and
mm-hmm.
I've tried to pin him down on exactly what he does and I can't quite figure it out. I hope it's legal. And yeah, so that's the 5 of us.
What does your sister do?
And my sister's an attorney. She's
okay.
She's an employment attorney who specializes in, gender equality cases,
oh,
which I think is so
great.
Badass.
Yeah.
She's tough as nails, my sister.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah.
Where does she fall birth order?
She's kind of my hero. She's 3rd out of 6.
Okay. And who's the oldest?
James.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, did he sort of, it's so remarkable that everyone from suburban St. Louis ended up going in the entertainment industry to some degree.
I know. We all went, you know, I got my one brother who's on the business side of things lives in New York, but the rest of us all live in Los Angeles, you know, I mean, I split my time between here and Atlanta and Los Angeles, but
yeah,
but I still, you know, we live in LA really.
Right. Yeah. That's really cool, man. I went to St. Louis for the first time last year. We did a live show with my other podcast there, Stuff You Should Know. And it was a cool town. I liked it.
Yeah.
Good people. Like legit city, but like being from the South, I identified with just like good, nice folks.
It's changed a lot. I don't go back there as much anymore. I've been going back a little more often to see my folks who still live in the same house, you know, that we grew up in.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, it's, I moved out at 18 and never went back. Like
yeah.
I went to Chicago for school and I never really called St. Louis home again. And so I still feel a little bit disconnected to it other than like a few things, you know.
Right.
Other than the Cardinals and my folks and
baseball fan,
big time.
Nice.
I'm a sports fan in general, actually, which is kind of a lot of people are surprised to hear that who know me well. They're like, you don't
really.
Well, I certainly was good at playing sports, you
right.
know. And but yeah, I like sports.
That's cool. I do too.
And yeah, so St. Louis, but it's changed a lot. That city, I think, is finally. From what I understand, I think it's finding its sea legs a little bit because for years it was just declining in population. Like from 19, it was one of the biggest cities in the country in 1950.
Yeah.
And then it got, you know, farther and farther down the list. And I think now it's really coming into its own as a smaller city. You know?
Right. Yeah. What was the major industry there? Besides beer, I guess.
Yeah.
Or is it beer?
It's McDonnell Douglas is there and Monsanto is there
Boo.
Purina is there
Yay.
And Budweiser. So like I would say those are probably TWA used to be there before they left town.
Yeah, yeah.
But those were the major industries that I can recall. I'm probably forgetting something, but yeah, Monsanto and McDonnell Douglas and Budweiser.
Now, did you act growing up? Was it something that all of you guys were sort of involved in early on?
Yes. And I think all my siblings were into acting and being on stage. They all did plays. At least they started doing plays in high school. I feel like I was sort of the most gung-ho about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they would say that same thing, but I think I'm the only one who, like, when you asked me when I was 6 years old what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said an actor.
Yeah.
But I used to go see all their plays in high school and like just I would want to be up there so bad. I would want to play every role that I saw.
Yeah.
You know?
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a large family consuming pop culture and movies. I mean, did you guys just sit around and watch movies and TV
constantly
as a group of siblings?
Constantly. Yeah,
that's
the TV was always on. And then once, like, you know, VCRs came around, you know, we were like the first kids in our school that I knew who had got a VCR, probably, you know. And I remember that there's a place called Uncle Toots.
Man, I love those old mom and pop shops.
Yeah, that rented. It was the first place in town, and they rented videos. And, you know, I don't even know what year that would have been. Early 80s, probably.
Yeah.
And the first movies we rented were Steve McQueen, The Hunter. It's one of them.
Oh, I love that movie.
And
he's
and
the bounty hunter.
Else. Yeah.
That was one of his last movies.
And
if
I
not
was
his
probably
last movie.
A little too young to watch that one. I don't think I watched all of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, and they were the rentals were $10 a piece.
Oh my God.
Which was incredibly expensive.
Like
they ended up, you know, within 5-6 years, they were $2 a Blockbuster.
Yeah, they were 4 for $10.
Yeah. But yeah, once we had a VCR, you know, we'd, in my family, there'd be 2 or 3 movies a night that were rented and they would just always be there.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like growing up, I almost always had the option of watching a movie with one of my siblings if I wanted to do that.
That's awesome.
That night. You know, like someone would go down to the basement and watch a movie. And so they were all, I was always a little younger when they were teenagers and whatever, but sometimes they'd go out, but sometimes they'd stay in and watch a movie and I could always watch that movie with them. And I often did.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I'm the youngest, only of three, but I definitely get that.
Yeah.
That thing and being the youngest. And
yeah.
When the older siblings shine a light on you and stuff, it's kind of fun.
That's the greatest thing about being the youngest is you get to absorb all of the...
Yeah.
All of the things that they, you know, like I don't know, just pulling an example off the top of my head, like even though I was born in 74, like I don't know when Frampton Comes Alive came out, but but it's part of the fabric of my
yeah.
childhood just because I would hear my older siblings and their friends talk about it.
Yeah.
Are things that were, you know, from the, that should have been before my time mm-hmm. feel like they weren't.
Yeah.
And then I got that all throughout, you know?
Yeah. I think I've talked to a lot of people in here and that's a common thread is like that it's usually a sibling that just that culture feed. And obviously as a younger, or if it's an old, you know, a neighbor or anything, anyone, it's always someone a few years older though.
Yeah.
That you're like, oh, well, they think that's cool. Then I'm fucking all over it.
Absolutely. And it was everything, you know, music.
Yeah.
Music, big time, movies, big time.
What kind of music?
Man, you know, my brothers, Jimmy and Patrick were really, I call James Jimmy still. We're really, they were kind of like old school. They were punks and then mods, you know.
Right.
Really into, like their tastes were just different enough that they covered all of that particular part of it.
Uh-huh.
And Jimmy was always, they were both always so into music that they always liked a little of everything.
Yeah.
So it's like Jimmy also, you know, they both loved Queen and loved, and Jimmy loved like Alice Cooper and,
yeah.
and some bands like that. But then they were also just super into The Clash and the Sex Pistols.
Right.
And I shared a room with my brother Patrick and he would listen to an album as he went to sleep every single night. And I didn't, I mean, the idea that I had a choice whether or not right. to listen to an album was not even in my register, you
sure.
know? But yeah. And so those, that was a lot of Elvis Costello,
uh-huh.
Split Ends, the Boomtown Rats.
Oh yeah.
You know, gosh, there's so much, you know, I could go on and on. But yeah, but then, you know, but then that continued. And then I also got into when my brother Brian got really into like Prince and,
yeah.
and you know, the Pixies a little later. And
that's kind
and
of the like great thing about
T-Rex. And
yeah, that like I'm a couple years older than you. But back then you could listen to Prince and Michael Jackson and also The Clash and whatever else. I mean, it was sort of that American Top 40 effect where
mm-hmm.
it was all in there.
Yeah.
You know, and every Sunday afternoon, Casey Kasem was kind of preaching the gospel, you know.
And then when I was 14, Straight Outta Compton came out. So I was like,
yeah,
right in the pocket of the cool kids in my school.
Yeah.
Got into rap. And then I started listening to Ice Cube. And I'm still now, I became this insane rap aficionado. And now I'm like early 90s hip hop all the way through. But like, that's what. Nowadays, I listen to like 90s hip hop and 70s like country folk singer songwriter music more than anything.
Is Joni Mitchell of the Far Side?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally. Right. Like,
that was when I listened to hip hop. I was talking to someone about it the other day. I haven't a lot since, but like 87 through mid 90s, like 87 through 97 with mm-hmm. Tribe and Far Side and. You
I've
know,
been talking for years. You'd probably be the guy to talk to about this, but I've been talking for years about doing a podcast about hip hop music, particularly focused on that era. Cause I go super, super deep. Like I'm a maniac for it. And I feel like I meet people who say that all the time that loved the hip hop from back then, and aren't as into it anymore. And I want to preach to them a little bit that, even from then, there's so much that I guarantee they haven't heard that what they would love.
Yeah.
That like, you know, if they went back and heard some of the old records from like particularly like 90 to 95.
Yeah.
You know?
We were into it.
Yeah.
It was a pretty like inspiring time.
Yeah.
To be listening to music, I think.
Yeah.
And I want to, it was the Stranger Things guys. And Gelman was saying that he's still really into it. And he's like, the new stuff is different, but he loves it. And I'm not one of these people that's like, ah, it's no good anymore.
Yeah.
It just sort of fell away from me a bit.
There's always great new music. You know what? I'm much less down on hip hop nowadays than I am on rock music. Like there's hip hop today that I'm like, if you know where to look for it, there's still great hip hop music being made. It's not on the radio, but there's still great. Whereas rock music, that's why I don't listen to modern rock music anymore.
I don't even know what that is.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like.
Or where it lives.
Even when I would hear bands that, like, you know, I guess this is now 5 or 10 years ago, that I would have friends that were really into, like, I don't know, like Band of Horses or Arcade Fire or like these bands, which I could hear it and recognize that it was good, but I'm like, I can't listen to this anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It's like, and it all feels derivative to me in some sense, but whatever.
It kind of is, actually.
Yeah.
And in fact, again, with the Joe Keery, he's a musician and in a band, and he was talking about that, how everything just sort of, everyone's just like, oh, they're doing sort of this, their version of this old classic group.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
So, like, how much ground can you break?
Yeah.
It was already broken.
I remember, like, I'll hear a, you know, like my friend was like, oh, this is so, you know, this band Toon Yards is so innovative. Like, they're so different.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear it and I'm like, this sounds exactly like this band from like 81.
Right.
You know, that I remember like almost exactly. Like it sounds, it's like the mix is a little different. But other than that, the music is almost the same as, anyway.
I just saw them open for David Byrne.
Toon Yards?
Uh-huh.
They are a good band. I'm not saying that like, oh,
no,
man,
it was good. Yeah. But I would say the same thing. Is that like, it's good stuff though.
Yeah.
In case they're listening. Well, so you mentioned college in Chicago. Was that, did you study acting there or was it just regular old college?
Totally. I went to the Goodman School of Drama.
Yeah, well, there you have it.
At DePaul University, and which was a full-on conservatory. Like I had, you know, I had very minimal credits of other kinds that I needed to take. It was like voice and speech, movement,
that's great.
Acting classes all the time.
It's like fully immersive.
Yeah. And I was really geared towards that my whole, you know, like I knew when I went to high school, I was a smart kid, but I would slack off in grades and I would tell my parents, I'm going to go to an acting school.
Right.
So my grades don't matter as much. And they would get so mad at me, but
really?
I won those arguments in retrospect.
Yeah, exactly.
But
in your face.
Yeah.
Mom and dad.
I know. But yeah, it was always, and I remember my parents went with me to the interview when I got into DePaul, because it was, I really just auditioned for like the three or four best programs, according to the books that I read,
right,
you know, in the country. And that was it. Mm-hmm. And this one was like, most of them said like Juilliard, Yale, DePaul, which was used to be the Goodman. And then they had to change the name, but, and so I got into, that's the one I got into.
Yeah.
And I remember going to the interview with my folks and them talking about how intense the program was and how you know, you'd be there all day and then you'd have rehearsals. And the first year you're just on crew for plays and you're basically, they take up your time from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. every single day.
Wow.
And you got cut at the end of they cut students at the end of each of the first 2 years.
Really?
They don't do that anymore, but they used to.
Huh.
And I remember my parents saying to me that they expected me to like shy away from it after I heard all that stuff, because I think they thought I was lazy.
Right.
But I was like, no, that's it. That's exactly what I want. I want to be doing that all the time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And did plays there, I guess?
I did tons of plays. I mean, one after another. The first year is like crew, and then the second year they're like workshop plays that you do in a classroom, and just the teachers see them and grade them and stuff like that. And then the third and fourth year, you're like in the casting pool where you could get cast in what was the main stage play, which is a massive theater. It's like it's held several thousand people downtown Chicago.
Yeah.
So like there was a lot of opportunity to act in front of, you know, like I did a kid's show in my third year of school, and we would have shows Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturday, like Tuesday and Thursday morning, and then Saturday matinee.
Wow.
For, you know, we ran for 10 weeks or something like that, mm-hmm. and playing in front of 2,000 people every single performance. So,
man,
like,
that's crazy.
Yeah. In college.
So you were like 19, 20 years old doing that?
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. I would have been almost 20, I guess.
Well, and that's such great training too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to learn it in the classroom, which is super valuable, but to throw you out on stage in front of like a legit crowd.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, now most of those were kids because it was the kids' play. But even when you did the other ones, like they wouldn't run for weeks and weeks, but you know, you'd run two weekends or whatever, mm-hmm. and you'd never fill the balcony, but you'd still be in front of hundreds and hundreds of people for, yeah. you know, and in a theater the size of the biggest, you know, I mean, as big as any is Broadway houses,
right.
you know, like
yeah.
this massive theater, the Merle Ruskin Theater. So that was really cool. It was super competitive. People got cut after each of the first 2 years, which was really intense.
Was it good competitive or sort of like healthy competitive?
It's hard for me to know.
Yeah.
These days. When I look back on those days, you know, Rooker went to the same school, by the way, Michael Rooker, my friend and you know, who I've worked with so much
uh-huh.
and over the years. And he went to the same school and he's always said he thinks that the cutting process was great.
Right.
He's like, that's exactly how hardcore it is. Once you, nobody babies you once you graduate.
Yeah, I mean, it's good training,
you know, the
real world training,
the acting world. Yeah. It's like,
it's brutal.
Being an actor can be just vicious,
mm-hmm.
you know, that can be, it remains vicious even after you've made it. But,
right.
But, and he loved it. I don't know. There's parts of me, I don't know. I don't know how I would do it differently if I ran the school. I know they don't cut people anymore. I know that I was very nearly cut, which a teacher confirmed to me
really?
Later afterwards that I was on the bubble, and I'd gotten warned. You'd get a warning, and
uh-huh.
And I was on the bubble. I was warned, and I had to do a final scene in front of the faculty, which we all did, and the faculty really thought I was really good in that scene, and they decided to keep me.
Do you remember what scene?
Yeah, definitely. It was from what is still a play that I still want to do right now, which is probably probably my second favorite play ever. And it's The Birthday Party by Harold Pinter.
Oh, yeah.
And the character of Stanley, who's like a, it's a great role for me. He's like, because he's, I don't know, it's insane introvert. I mean, I don't know why I say it's a perfect role for me, but it feels like it is when I read it.
Right.
And I did that scene with my friend Jennifer Ellison, who's still a like magnificent theater teacher and does like these great avant-garde plays in Chicago. And I guess it was good enough to save me.
Yeah.
But I think back on that and I'm like, If I'd had a really bad day that day, or if I had spit the bit somehow, mm-hmm. you know, and had a bad scene and then I got cut, I don't know how much that would have devastated certainly my career,
right.
but probably my whole life.
Would have?
Yeah.
yeah.
I think it would have had an absolutely traumatic effect on my entire life.
Like you would have quit, do you think?
I honestly do not know what I would have done.
Yeah.
I think I probably was fragile enough that I would have quit, and I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah.
I don't know what I would, and I still had a big enough ego that at that time I didn't think I was that close.
Right.
It wasn't, I was like, God, was I really? And then I asked this teacher after I graduated, I was like, was I really close? And he went, Oh yeah. You were really close. And I was like, holy.
Yeah.
You know, it freaked me out. And so now I look back and I'm like, was that a good Is that a positive way to treat a human being who's 22 years old?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's interesting.
No, I wouldn't have been. It was after my second year. So I would have been
younger than that.
You know, 19 or 20, just turned 20.
Yeah.
And is that the right way to treat a 20-year-old who is trying with everything in their power to learn a craft?
Yeah.
Probably not, I think, is my answer to that question.
Yeah. I might agree with you there.
But I don't know. It's complicated, you know?
Yeah.
And then I look back, I got a buddy now who I went to school with who is a great actor who works a lot less than he should.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk sometimes about, I'm like, yeah, I was a much better actor when I graduated from this conservatory, but I also aged from 18 to 22.
Yeah.
How much better would I have been if I just
started
moved
acting.
To LA and got in a class and started trying to get auditions? Like, I don't know. I have no idea how much it helped me in the long run.
Right.
Made me who I am, but was it good? I don't know.
Did you have fun?
Yes, I did. And definitely the best thing about it was I met these certain people that are still like a core part of my, not just my best friends, but of my like collaborative community. You know,
that's
my
cool.
friend Valentine Mealy, who's done some movies for my brother, who's a great actor, and my friend John Cabrera, who's now almost entirely like writing and creating, and Judy Greer, my old friend, who's doing great.
She's an old friend.
Yeah, oh yeah, she was a year behind me in school.
She is the best.
She's amazing, and she's she's as good of a friend as I will ever have in my life.
Oh, man, that's good to know that she's
cool. I performed her wedding ceremony. I was the officiant of her
wedding. That's great.
Yeah. She's
man,
great.
I just
she's
love
amazing.
Her.
I could go on and on about what an amazing person she is. But yeah, and so there's all these friends that I've, this like sort of main little group of friends that I made that was definitely the best. That was probably worth it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
For sure.
You know, and maybe that's why you're there, really, is just for that.
I mean, yeah. My college experience, I could probably say the same thing.
At the end of the day, I don't know.
Yeah. So did you go to L.A. kind of right after that, or?
I spent 1 year in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
For some reason, and I look back at this now as being so fucked up, but they really encouraged you at my school to just, like, have this sort of, to stick your nose up at not just L.A., but acting on camera in general. And it was like theater actors are real actors.
Right.
And film and TV actors are like slumming it or like,
I think
you
that's
know,
still a thing for
like,
sure.
Yeah. And you hear so many people like, I want to do, you know, like my goal would be to do just enough like work on TV and film to support my theater habit. Like, like you hear people say that and there are people that do that. But I'm like, it's mostly full of shit. Some of those people, a lot of those people are great actors and like are really, but I don't know. For me, what happened was, okay, so I graduated and we were like, we're going to start a theater company and do plays and do these weird plays. I was directing a lot of theater at that time. But by the time I graduated, I'd really gotten into directing theater. And
I bet that's fun.
I love it. It's something I haven't done in years and I miss it.
Mm-hmm.
So we started this theater company. We did open this coffee shop that had a theater in the basement.
Yeah.
And did that for like a year. And we were pretty okay at running a theater company and not good at running a coffee shop.
So it was part of it?
Yeah, it was like part of the whole thing. And my friends and I started this thing and so we did shows downstairs and I did some work. Like, I directed a couple of plays that I was really super, super proud of. Another Pinter play, The Hot House, that I directed that I'm like, this is awesome. And, like, we were all too young to be, they were all, I was directing, but the actors were all too young to play the roles, but still.
Right.
I was like, I'm really proud of this work, and we ran for 6 weeks or whatever, but. When you add it all together, what, it maybe 300, you know, like 500 people see this play.
Yeah.
And then I did a commercial for the Illinois Lottery, and I got paid, and tons of people I knew saw it, said that they saw it, and you know, it was all over, and people saw my face, and then that was, And I was like, there's got to be a way to marry these two things where I do something that I love.
Right.
And that I'm proud of, but that but you're a not lot in the black of people box theater. Yeah. See. And then I did this movie, this not good independent movie called Stricken, but that was my first taste of like, I like it was on location. We went up to right. Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And, Jamie Kennedy, this actor from who used to be my very good friend back in the day, and I haven't seen him in many years. But he was in that movie, and so he came from L.A.
Right.
A couple of the actors came from L.A. And I would talk to them about what it was like to act out there, and I remember very vividly that that Jamie and I had auditioned for this play at a really reputable theater in Chicago. A court theater that did was really great theater that did a lot of Shakespeare and classic plays. And I had auditioned and I was waiting to hear from them. And then while I was doing this movie, and I remember going out one night with Jamie and a couple other people. Judy was in that movie too, by the way. Judy Greer was in that movie too. And coming back to the hotel and Jamie having a manila envelope there waiting for him with script just delivered to him to read and see if he was interested in. And I was like, I want that.
Right.
I want somebody delivering a script to me to see if I'm
consider.
Interested.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's what I want. And and about a week or so later, I got the part at the court theater and it was like, either this will be your first paid, acting job. They were gonna make me equity and pay me like $300 a week or something, which was really good for a theater actor. But it was Chicago winter. It was gonna run from I'd been thinking about moving to LA.
Right.
And I was gonna have to stay then instead of moving in October, I was gonna stay through February or March or whatever.
The worst time.
For the Chicago thing. And I'm like, nah. If I put it off, I may just keep putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. And so I moved to LA with nothing.
As a kid, really.
Yeah.
Looking back, I mean, you're early 20s.
But I had a lot of confidence at that time because in that year in between graduating and when I left, I started auditioning first, like in addition to the movie, I also did a bunch. I booked like 7 commercials in 4 months or something.
Right.
And so I got this idea that, I can get hired. Like I can, if I can get auditions, I can get jobs. I'm starting to learn how to get jobs.
Right.
And so I had a lot of confidence that like, if I can just get an agent, I'll be able to book work.
How tough is it to learn how to audition? Cause that's a brutal, I used to, when I was a PA years ago in LA, I used to occasionally just run camera on casting sessions. And I remember just sitting there thinking, my God, what a brutal process.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you this. They did a very poor job of teaching us how to do it at the theater school that I went to.
Yeah,
at
least they should do more of that, right? Audition.
Like, I was great at auditioning for theater, and then you hardly ever do that.
Right.
Or at least I did. And then, we had one on-camera class in our fourth year, and it was not great. And I think that it is – I think it's something that – every actor really needs to think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have a knack for it. I'm very, very lucky in that I was pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I knew for sure actors that I thought were, you know, no worse than I was, who I thought were terrific actors that did not have the audition skills that I had.
It's almost like being like, I'm smart, but I'm not a good test taker.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of focus you need to be able to audition well and confidence for sure.
Yeah.
You know, you can't ever seem like you need the job or you're dead in the water.
But also I imagine you also have to walk a line between being too cocky or.
Yeah, totally. Totally. To be honest, I know I'm okay. I still don't know if I'm that good at it. You know, like I know that I was good then because I was getting booked a lot. And now it's like now, even though I don't even have to do it all the time now, there are times when I know that I like everything. There's so many self-tapes now.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a couple times when I audition for things where I make my own tape, and I love it. I think it's great,
yeah.
You know? And I send it in, and, like, I don't get it, or I don't, right. Doesn't move any further, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing wrong there, but it certainly felt good.
But also, with a little bit of age and experience, you also know that there are a million reasons that have nothing to do with how good you are.
Totally. I've been on the other side now, too. I've auditioned people for stuff. You know, I've been a producer on a project where I see things, or, you know, where I've, you know, a friend will be casting something and show me three or four audition tapes and say, who do you like the best and why? And so I know what goes into that. And I know how truly, not random, but like, it's like sometimes you get somebody who's like, I don't know, I just really see this character having dark hair or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like sometimes that's it. Or sometimes like, they look a little too much, like whatever. They're like, I pictured him being, you know, 10 years older. And there's always so many things. That said, I also do think that I still think, I mean, this is easier for a working actor to say than a non-working one, but I do still think that if you're good enough, you'll make it.
Right.
You know?
That's got to be a little heartening.
And driven.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have enough drive.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like it may take you a longer time.
Right.
You know? But I feel like if you're good at it, you'll make it. I think that's especially true of writers and directors. I feel like that's true. Mm-hmm. And I still feel like my favorite thing is that I feel like my work is getting better. You know, like trying to be a better actor now than mm-hmm. I ever was is like not only something I'm really driven by, but it's also one of the great joys of my life. Like that makes me want to get out of bed in the morning, wanting to like play a role and be better than I've ever been in anything else. Like, you know.
Yeah, I imagine even Meryl Streep is still learning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a job where you shut it down and you're like, all right, well, I kind of know all the tricks.
Yeah.
I'm sure you develop a bag of tricks, but it's kind of one of the cool things. It's like a living, breathing thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been one of the weird things about now I'm segueing for you, but one of the weird things about working on the Avengers movies has been working with so many just extraordinarily famous and successful actors, you know, on a daily basis and seeing what their relationship to their job is, you know? And for the most part, it's really good, but you also see people who like, you know, Hollywood gets you down and you get burnt out.
Yeah.
And being famous makes your job harder. I mean, I know it's like boohoo. I don't want to, you know, it's like people who are famous have it easier in so many ways, but as an actor, when you're famous, people start treating you differently.
Right.
And part of your craft has to be understanding how people behave.
Mm-hmm.
And so just there's a little bit of a disconnect between those two things. So,
so
you get more and more famous, it gets harder and harder in some ways to like sort of understand how people behave, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know. I think they get burnt out on it. That's why I kind of like try to be able to have my career and then also step out of it and have a bird's eye view of it and make sure I can watch it.
Yeah, man, Guardians was such a cool movie. Like, and I'm into all the Marvel stuff, but when that came out, I wasn't one who ever read like the comics. So I didn't know anything about that series or whatever, those characters. And I was just blown away, man. It was so original and fun, and it was a world that I'd never seen, and the spaceships looked different than I'd ever seen. Like, everything about it was just so original and fun. And you had a bigger part in the second one, even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so proud of those movies and proud of my brother. You know,
For sure.
They're really, I mean, there's so many different creative minds that go into a project like that, but you also
imagine that undertaking.
You need a captain steering the whole ship, mm-hmm. you know, pointing it in the right direction. And like those movies are so much my brother. They're just like so much like him. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah, for
and,
sure.
And he's a maniac. He's the most, he prepares to a degree that is just insane. So he kind of has a lot of the movie in his head already when we even start filming, and we
right.
get to see, you know, full animatics of every scene. And mm-hmm. he has, like all of the songs on the soundtrack are, they get the rights before they start shooting so that we can actually often like play them on set to the scenes that they're
right.
playing under. And
which really sets the mood.
And some of the score is also, mm-hmm. Tyler Bates does some of the score for some key scenes, particularly like fight scenes and things like that, so that they can be choreographed to like sort of a rough version of the score and
yeah.
things like that. And my brother is like way into all that stuff.
Yeah.
And he has his hands in everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no detail in that movie, in either of those movies, that weren't completely his idea or at least okayed by him. There's nothing that he's like, oh, you know, like it's everything he manages the
yeah,
shit out of everything.
I think there is an incorrect notion out there in some people's minds that for a movie that size, and all movies take a great number of people, don't get me wrong, as you know, mm-hmm. to make it successful on screen, but that somehow a director is not as involved as in something like that as like a smaller movie, and which James, I mean, he started his career with those small budget trauma movies mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that's just bullshit, right?
Right. Totally. Totally. I mean, I might say that if you get to a certain level and you're directing a movie that big, you might have more of an opportunity to yes.
Yeah.
You might have more of an opportunity to coast than you would if you were making a small budget movie.
Right.
Where you got to get your hands dirty or the movie's not going to get made.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think it's any, like, the movie's going to suck if you do.
Mm-hmm.
The movie's, you know, so I don't think it's any, I don't think it's any less important to be sort of totally on top of everything you're doing
right.
in a big budget movie.
Yeah.
You know, the job is a little different, but it's not a lot different.
Right. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Where do you stand for Guardians 3? Can you talk about that or?
I don't know exactly. So, I mean, I was in the sort of rare position where I had not quite finished my deal. So I was still sort of negotiating for the movie when, you know, all the nonsense that happened with my brother, and he got in trouble for old tweets, which was a very strange experience.
Yeah.
But for me, I was just sort of put out in limbo, and I think that I do believe that the movie is going to get made, but I don't know when.
Yeah.
I do believe I will be involved, but I don't know for sure.
Right.
And I've been in the business now long enough to know that until something is actually happening, it's
right.
not happening.
Yeah.
So I'm just living my life and my career as though it's never going to get made.
Right.
But I hope I get, you know, I hope I get news to the contrary.
It was such a fun group. I can't even remember the guys, the group of dudes.
Which groups?
Well,
of dudes?
I mean, the gang of sort of space rednecks.
Oh, and the Ravagers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was just such a, like, you were all so funny. I know Steve Agee a little bit, so.
I love Steve Agee.
He had such a good time.
He's become a good friend.
And, yeah.
Yeah, and, yeah. And Rooker and,
yeah, Rooker's
and
so
all
great.
Those guys. My old friend Evan Jones is in it. And,
did you guys, like, kind of form a, I know sometimes on movies like that, like, you're sort of form the unit.
Yeah, and a lot of us
set.
Knew each other already. But yeah, I think the Ravagers feel a special
uh-huh.
kinship with one another. And Chris Sullivan, whose career is blowing up now, who he's on This Is Us, and he's in Stranger Things, and he used to be on The Nick, and he's an
right.
amazing actor, like one of the best I've ever known, probably. And he played Taserface.
Okay.
And getting to know him and have him be he's such a great member of an ensemble.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was awesome. And that's the other, like, that's the other thing I will say about my brother is that he does a great job of doing his homework about people.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to like finding good actors, he finds good people.
Right.
Because you're going to be, you know, making a movie together for 6 months or more.
You don't want to work with assholes.
And yeah, you don't want to work with assholes. Life is too short for like diva nonsense and things like that.
Yeah.
And so, and it's why, you know, like I love a lot of the people I've worked with over the years for different reasons, but like Chris Pratt and Zoe and Dave Bautista and Pom and Karen and Michael Rooker, mm-hmm. you know, and several more, but that sort of main group of the Guardians family, they really do feel like family to me. I love them. And,
that's great.
And I would gladly go to battle with any one of them.
Yeah, Pratt is so funny in those movies.
He's so great.
I mean, he's funny anyway. I was a big fan from
he's a great dude
years ago. But
yeah,
I mean, he's just so funny. And then in the Avengers movie, some of the best stuff was he and Robert Downey Jr. going at it.
Yeah, I know. I love that.
Great. I love it. And Bautista, who knew? Who knew that that guy was that fucking funny?
Oh man, it was one of the great joys for me. It was like. Because I was there when Dave had his screen tests, because I, you know, worked with my brother for so long. He wanted my help with various things along the way.
Right.
And so for a lot of the actors' screen tests, I would read Quill with the Draxes mm-hmm. or and Rocket with the Quills.
Right.
And so I got to see a lot of people audition. And Bautista came in for a work session before he had his screen test, and he was like so nervous and so quiet.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh man, this poor guy is just going to tank, you know, like he can't, like he's obviously this pressure is going to be too much for him.
Right.
And he's so good. He was so good.
Oh yeah. I mean, he stole that first movie in a lot of ways.
He's so good. He's like great. And he loves it. It's like a perfect microcosm of the whole movie, you know, he loved the material so much, you know, and like I think he was so happy to be able to play that role every day and like, and he was so grateful and so great to have around, and what a champion he is. He'd have like 4 or 5 hours of makeup, a lot of which he needs to keep his arms outstretched the whole time.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
or stand during tons of it.
Yeah.
And like, what a champion.
Yeah. I just thought it was so sweet how much he got your brother's back.
Yes.
That was great. It was cool to see.
Yeah. I thought it was amazing. And I was not at all surprised, to be honest. I hope that Dave it takes that as a compliment that like I've always known that Dave is a stand up of a guy as you'd ever want to meet.
Yeah.
Like I could rely on that guy. He's as trustworthy as anybody I've ever known.
That's great.
Yeah.
Before we move on to our film, I want to talk about the Gilmore Girls for a minute because
you're such a fan.
Well, I met you a few weeks ago at a wedding in Santa Barbara of a mutual friend. You were seated at my table.
Yes.
At our dinner table.
Yeah, the Atlanta posse.
Yeah, yeah. And my wife, Emily, who you met, she's like, who is that guy? And I was like, that's Sean Gunn. She's like, yeah, but who is he? I was like, he was in Guardians. She didn't see that.
Right.
And then it hit me. I was like, he was in Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, there
you go. And she was like, oh, of course, because she was a big fan.
Yeah.
And just couldn't quite place it.
Yeah, that was...
You were such a fresh face. Youngin and Gilmore Girls, looking back.
Yes, and that was an interesting, that was an interesting ride, Gilmore Girls. And
was
still
that kind
is.
Of the first big one?
Yeah, you know, I started booking pretty well. Like, when I finally started getting jobs in L.A., I was doing, like, lots of like, little guest star and co-star roles, mm-hmm. and I, you know, recurred on a couple of shows, just, like, got a second episode or whatever.
Right.
And
working actor, man, that's...
And I, yeah.
Totally the way to do it.
I did that. I auditioned for Gilmore Girls, which was a co-star role. My agent at the time recommended that I pass on the audition because they thought that I was better, that I should start just focusing on guest stars and not take co-stars, where if you're in the world, you know, guest stars like a notch above, you know.
Uh-huh.
I thought that I shouldn't, it was, it was an audition for the DSL installer, which ages me and the show. But but it was that was the character's name.
Yeah.
And it was one scene, and I was like, and I said to my my manager was like, you know, your agent doesn't want you to pass on this, but I know, you know, Mark Casey, one of the casting directors from Chicago, and she's really cool, and it'd be good to get in front of her and read something, and it, I think, you know, I don't see any harm if you you're interested. And I was like, well, I'll read the scene, and if it's, you know, if it's interesting at all, I'll audition. You know, I just didn't want to be like, you know, may I offer you a chicken leg?
Right.
and so I read it, and it was like, I was like just a little page long, page and a half long scene, but it was really funny. And I understood the, tone of it and everything. And I went in and I got that job, went on my, you know, had my day of work and it was fun and whatever. And I was like, okay, well, that's whatever, another one. And then a couple of weeks later, my manager called me and said, hey, you're booked for another episode of Gilmore Girls. I'm like, what? Really? No kidding. So they're bringing bringing back the DSL installer.
Was that season one? That
was the very beginning? One. That was the first episode. It was episode two of season one I was on. So they shot the pilot in Toronto, and then this was their first episode in shooting in at Warner Brothers, on the Warner Brothers lot.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, wow, they're bringing back this character. And then I read the role, and it was a different – it was a like a guy delivering swans to a wedding.
Yeah.
And I learned later that what happened was they'd seen a couple of actors to audition for this swan delivery guy. And Amy Palladino, the creator of the show, said to the casting directors, now, I want a guy like that guy who played the DSL installer.
Yeah.
And Jamie Rudofsky, who was the other casting director – bless her heart, said to Amy, why don't you just hire that guy again? You know,
like
and have it be just like a thing where it's weird. And I guess Amy thought about it. She's like, she thought it was kind of a funny idea.
Yeah.
And so they hired me again. And then it became a running joke on the show that I would pop up all over town. Like,
yeah.
And so I kept getting, it kept asking me back episode after episode to, I ended up doing 11 episodes that first season. And I would just pop up wherever when they needed somebody. And then they gave my character a name, and I became sort of a townsperson. But I thought every episode I did would be my last. And then
how many years were you on that show?
It ended up being seven.
That's crazy.
All seven. So, yeah. So then I did 2 years like that. I did another 17 episodes the second year. And then they asked me to be a series regular because I was maybe going to go do another show. And so it was never something that, like, I never got that moment where it was like, yes, I got this amazing role, you
right,
know?
Right.
It just always was something that just sort of kind of continued. And I always thought, well, this will go away at some point.
Right.
And not only did it, so then the craziest thing about that story is, so then not only did it, then I became series regular, did the show five more seasons as a regular. Then the show went away. It ended in 2007. And it was a modest hit for the CW, but it wasn't a massive, massive show.
It was a popular show though.
But it was modestly popular.
Yeah.
And then about 6 or 7 years later, it got on Netflix.
Yeah.
And it became massive.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yes. Then it became, people started binge watching it.
Mm-hmm.
It started, and also when the DVD sales were great.
Right.
So like when it first came out, it was like an early binge watching show.
Yeah.
And so when the DVD sets sold way better than tons of shows that performed better at the ratings when it was on originally. And then it was on Netflix, and then it just became this massive,
that's great,
like almost this cultural phenomenon to the point that when Netflix then decided to bring it back and shoot more episodes, which we did in 2016.
Yeah.
Like I was on the Tonight Show. I mean, it was amazing. It was, it was mind blowing. It really was. It was like, this is something I worked on a decade ago.
I know.
You know,
that's
and
so
now
funny.
It's more popular. I started getting, you know, like I got recognized here and there from it back in 2006, 2007 at the end of its run. I had, you know, but then 2014, 15, everywhere I went all the time.
Uh-huh. Like 30 to 40 year old ladies.
Yeah. Yeah. And still, and then they got younger again. And then they also, when the, with the revival and stuff, younger, like, and like tons of, like, I used to watch this as a kid and now I watch it with my daughter.
For sure.
I hear that all the time, which is really heartwarming.
That's really cool. That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
What a cool little, like, surprise.
I'm lucky. It was great material and it was great. It was, I loved it. Going back to do it again was amazing because it was fun in a way that, like, originally I was like, oh, yeah, I'm doing this kind of silly little show, but.
The writing was really pretty good, though.
It was great.
Like, I've seen enough of them with Emily that to recognize, like, good, snappy.
Yes.
Kind of throwback, snappy dialogue.
Amy Palladino is really a genius, and her husband, Dan, is right there with her. And they it's like I was saying with my brother. Amy has her, knows exactly what she wants. She has her hands in everything.
Yeah.
And everything that's done. And I didn't properly appreciate that. You know, when I did my first episode, I was 26 and she's only a few years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought of her as like my boss.
Right.
But looking back and thinking like this is a woman in her like early 30s
mm-hmm.
who's the showrunner of this thing and is trying to battle with a network that wants to tell her what to do. And she's like, no, I know what to do.
That's pretty badass.
Badass. Yeah. Totally. Totally.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's awesome. All right, man. We will move on into California Split.
Yeah.
A movie that I'm a little ashamed to say I had never seen until this morning.
Oh, I watched it this morning too.
Did you?
Yeah.
You should have come over.
Yeah. I don't think that there's any embarrassment. I rarely meet people that have seen it.
Well, I'm a big Altman fan though. Like this one just got past me.
Yeah. I am too. And my if I were to list my top 10 favorite movies of all time,
mm-hmm.
which is something I would probably do because we love making lists in my family. I don't know why. I think it's an offshoot of narcissism that like, that like if it's on your list, like you're bestowing it
right.
like knighthood or something like that. I think Long Goodbye, Nashville and California Split would all be maybe top six or seven.
And like, were those three all in a row? Because I know Long Goodbye and this one were back-to-back.
They're very close. Thieves Like Us was right in there, too, which is also a great movie.
I haven't seen that one either.
That one's even more obscure, and it's really good, but I put it a notch below these three. A lot of people put California Split a notch below Long Goodbye and Nashville, which I get for various reasons.
Sure.
But it's in some ways less ambitious, but, I mean, everything's less ambitious than Nashville.
That is for sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like I still love those movies, the way Altman made movies. He's got another, like, he's way more hit and miss for the rest of his career, but I also very, very much like MASH and Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean's I think is a really strong movie, and The Player's a good movie, maybe a little overrated, but
Shortcuts.
Yeah.
I found a lot of DNA in this film in Shortcuts when I watched it, in that just sort of the, and you lived in, do live in LA, so you know that LA thing. It's a different sort of, like the underbelly sort of lowlife LA is completely different than New York.
Yes.
And it's a very specific thing. And Altman just nails it.
Yes. California Split is a very L.A. movie.
Yeah.
And it's also a very, like, there are a lot. I almost said I could go on and on talking about this movie, but I guess that's why I'm here.
Exactly.
There's a lot of elements of it that are very personal to me. Just in terms of gambling and, like, I love the, I don't just love gambling. I love the gambling lifestyle.
Oh, yeah.
And I love that that sort of, like, you know, what Elliot Gould's character, Charlie, you know, the way he lives his life is something that that I've been drawn to forever.
Interesting.
Like the idea, and I see a parallel between that and being an actor.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're going to live outside of the bounds of, you know.
Yeah.
I always thought, I remember having like an argument with my brother Matt a couple years ago where he brought up something about that I had said I would never have a 9-to-5 job. Like mm-hmm. I would never, and I think he misinterpreted that I thought that I was better than a 9-to-5 job.
Right.
You know, that like, that was beneath me. But I'm like, no, I just could, I would and could never do it.
Right.
Like it's not in my brain. Like it's not in my capability to do that.
Right.
And I think Charlie's like that.
Right.
You know, I mean, obviously he's like that.
Yeah.
Just like not, you know, like when he's, like when he goes to Bill, you know, the George Segal character, when he's like goes to Bill's job, and there's no part of him that would ever dream of doing that.
Yeah.
You know, those characters are so, it's one of the other things that's so great about it is that they're so different from one another.
You know,
those two guys are so different, but I think I have both those characters inside of me in a sense a little bit. Some of Bill's like sort of self-reflective stuff.
Yeah, they are different. And when I was watching it, I kind of, and see what you think about this, it kind of felt like to me, like kind of up until the end, really, which, you know, we'll get to that end scene, which is like one of the best ever.
Yes.
But Charlie, I feel like kind of feels like we're the same, you and me.
Yeah.
But they're not at all.
Right. Yeah.
But he finds this new friend.
Mm-hmm.
That he, like a lot of, you know, these guys are obviously, especially Charlie, at like a gambling addict, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
In sort of a fun way. That's
impossible. I mean, I don't think, he's not a gambling addict the way that you think of a gambling addict who just like loses loses everything, you know, or like is always just. They just prefer the action.
It's fun for him.
Yeah.
Because he bets on everything.
Right.
And that's part of the fun of the movie. Like, it's really interesting because they bill it as a comedy,
mm-hmm.
which it is funny in a lot of places,
mm-hmm.
but it's just got such a dark Altman-esque.
It's how Altman makes comedies,
underbelly,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not going to make it straight up. I mean, look what he did with Popeye, for Christ's sake.
Oh, man. I love it.
But
I got to see Popeye again.
But he had, it's a fucking weird movie, man.
Yeah.
It was fun rewatching it recently. But Charlie has fun gambling. Like, he can't just go out and play some pickup basketball. He's betting these guys that he can beat them in one-on-one.
Yes.
Or, you know, sort of a sad scene was at the very beginning when he and George Segal first hook up and they are sort of drunk at the end of the night at the bar and he bets him whether or not he can name the seven dwarfs. And it's funny, but it's also
so
depressing, though. It's like both at the same time.
Because my buddy and I would quote that all the time.
Yeah.
Here comes seven like a Gatling gun.
Yeah.
Sleepy, grumpy Doc. That's four.
Three.
That's three.
Like a Gatling gun.
Here comes seven.
There's sleepy, so many great lines.
Sleepy, grumpy Doc.
Yeah.
That's four. That's three. But yeah, no, I know. It's yeah, they'll bet on. But you know, it's Bill's the one who's a gambling addict.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because he's the one that has lost his life
exactly.
because of it. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's a good point. I never really considered that.
And you know, I don't know which direction this conversation should go, but I can tell you my sort of larger idea. But like what this movie means to me is, it's like, I feel like it's more of a kind of psychological. How do I put this? It's like Waiting for Godot in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that these it's like a metaphysical statement, you know, like the idea that gambling is an allegory for the way everyone lives their lives.
Yeah.
Is very apparent to me.
Yeah.
Like I would say, I've said to people before, and I know Charlie would say this too,
mm-hmm.
that it's all gambling, man.
Yeah.
You know, like everything you do is a gamble, you know, like,
right.
like people think it's weird. You know, I've had stretches of my life where I'll go, and I certainly don't think I'm like, I haven't lost enough money to be, you know, I like playing the odds. I like the math of gambling, you know, more than the action. But I've had periods in my life where, like, I'll go for a week and, you know, whatever, gamble. Like, I'll bet on sports and play poker and just do that for stretches at a time, or
it's,
do
it's
it
fun.
A lot for months at a time, you know? And, like, it's all – and then it's, like, it's really not – it's almost no different than playing the stock market.
Yeah, totally.
And it's almost no – like, everything you do, being an actor is a gamble. Being, you know, starting a podcast is a gamble. It's, like, the getting married's a gamble.
Yeah.
So it's, like, there's all – there's this element of what your relationship is to yourself as a gambler, you know, that is – I think the movie feels like a meditation on that to me. If I'm really reading into it as much as I can, which is why I'm here.
Right.
And so I really think that the idea that the two ways that these guys look at their lives covers a lot of ground in terms of the way all human beings look at their lives.
Yeah.
And what their relationship is to how much they're willing to sort of let go and how much they need to hold on to.
Yeah.
And yeah, we can get to that end scene, but we can get to that later if you want. Yeah.
Let's hang on to that for now. But again, it's still funny in a lot of places. It's tonally, I mean, Altman was always such a master, I think, at mixing tones.
Yeah.
Actually, Emily worked with him and my brother. My brother was a DGA trainee years ago. And his first assignment was to shadow Robert Altman on The Player for like 4 days.
Wow.
And it was just a, you know, like, he's never been on set before. Just shadow Robert Altman.
Oh, God.
Which is really cool.
Did he like him? I mean,
yeah,
it's like
great.
He gets mixed reviews of Altman from like their people.
Well, Emily produced or was the UPM on Gingerbread Man.
Oh, really?
That shot in Savannah years ago.
Yeah.
And so she was there like hardcore in there for the whole shoot. And she said he was great.
Yeah.
He smoked pot constantly out of his little one-hitter, like it was a cigarette, all day long, which I was like, great.
You can tell when you see his movies.
But, you know, he was very famous for inviting the actors to watch dailies together at the end of the day. It was like a viewing party. And I don't know, man, he was just such a – I know everyone always calls him a maverick, but he really was.
Yo, totally.
Like, and he played by his own rules, which is so commendable.
If you watch his movies now – I mean, it's why he's such an artist. I mean, if you watch his movies now, like you sit down and watch Long Goodbye in Nashville and California Split and MASH and – oh, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. That's the other one.
Like,
that's another
that one.
I totally forgot that one. That's almost top 10 for me too.
Yeah.
Top 20 probably for me. But like, they – like, and you watch those movies, you can't, you see the auteur theory of films. You see that, like, you're never going to have somebody that's like, oh, he's a lot like Altman.
Right.
Like, you're not, that artist isn't really, they're either stealing from him or
they're doing their own Altman
thing, but nothing feels the way his movies feel to me.
Yeah, he didn't, and this one, he even, I think Altman admitted that this one was maybe had the thinnest plot of them all, which says a lot.
Yeah.
Because he never followed any sort of traditional, like, there were never, like, movie moments that you recognize as, like, the movie moment.
Mm-hmm.
It was just shit, like, life unfolding.
Yeah.
And there happened to be a master filmmaker, like, collecting the data and then letting you watch it.
Yeah.
This all feels so real.
It's so funny to me because I'm normally not like that as a viewer. Like a lot of times I'll criticize, like, you need a plot. The movie has to have a it has to have a forward thrust for the same character.
And I love movie moments.
Like, or you don't. Yeah. And it's like and it should be theatrical. And I'm sure I've criticized many movies for doing all the things that California Split does, you know,
I just didn't do it as well.
It just works. It makes me feel something that I understand more than, and it's why I've always hung on to it as my favorite. You know, it's like one that I've always been like. Here's another thing about it. I always feel like it's really rare that I would ever meet, and I haven't yet, but that I would ever meet anyone else who would say it's their favorite movie of all time. You know, it feels special to me in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like that, you know?
For sure. Yeah, that's cool. It reminded me, too. Have you ever seen the movie Fat City?
No.
The boxing movie?
No. I know the movie, but I haven't seen it.
You should check that out.
I will.
It has some, it's a lot of similarities to this in that, in that movie, it's alcoholism, but there's this down and out boxer and he latches onto this woman and they're immediately like living together. And that was sort of like, Charlie and, Bill,
mm-hmm.
they met, I mean, you would think if you walked in on the movie 8 minutes in, you would think, oh yeah, these guys are old friends.
Yeah.
And not having just met each other. And again, in the Altman way, it wasn't some profound meeting. It just sort of happened at the beginning.
Yeah. I love that it's a reveal that they, Altman almost teases that they might be working together.
Yeah, that's what it feels like.
Well, I mean, he definitely teases. Yeah. That they could be working together at the beginning of the movie, that they could be in cahoots with one another.
But they weren't, right?
No, they weren't. Okay. Because you see them separately, and then you follow one of them. And so then when Charlie enters the bar, it could easily at that point have him walk over and sit down and say, "Hey, that was great. We made this." But you know,
I kind of thought that was coming.
But no, there you see them actually meet each other, and it's mm-hmm. like, oh, these guys are destined to meet each other.
Yeah,
They're
they
not.
Just happened into the same. And again, that bar, like,
which
you
also
spent
makes
any time
it,
in LA. It was
yeah.
such an LA like.
Oh God, that bar's still probably in LA and looks yeah. just like that.
It reminded me, my bar when I lived there was a bar called the Drawing Room in Los Feliz.
Dude, I live blocks away from the Drawing Room.
Yeah,
in LA,
and it's actually when I lived there, it did go through one change. I don't know. I mean, have you ever been there? Do you ever go in there?
Many times.
Okay. But years ago, were you there when they had the United States map on the wall?
Oh,
before
God.
It went through there. Here's what happened. When I first
I don't know when that
there.
Happened, but I was there as early as 98. So.
Okay. Well, that was sort of right then because
yeah.
they had the whole wall was a mural of a map of the United States and it was dingy and awesome and gross. And then they shot a TV commercial or a TV show in there and got the most minor of makeovers in that they put in like another mural on the wall that was just fancier looking, but it still stayed kind of gross. And do you remember Henry? Do you remember the barfly Henry?
Yeah.
Old black guy, Henry?
Yeah.
He, I've sat and drank next to Henry many a night over the years
uh-huh.
back in the day. And Henry was a former actor, which I never knew.
Wow.
And, that sad LA bar scene is
oh, dude.
Barfly scene is
and
so
there's
interesting.
A bunch like that. And I'm I'm about to sound like an alcoholic. I swear I'm not. I'm
as neither, we're drinking as I, we record this.
I know. I'm neither a gambling addict nor an alcoholic. But I really like have this affection for all the 6 a.m. bars and all the bars that open at 6 a.m.
in totally
LA.
I totally do.
And there's a bunch of them.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, you know. Like the Frolic Room or the,
yep.
which might open at 11, but anyway, and there's like these drunks bars and yes, that's exactly what that bar feels like in California Split. But
yeah.
I always liked that. I don't know if it's, I'm sure a psychotherapist might say that it has something to do with like, I don't know, growing up kind of sheltered in the suburbs
yeah,
and white,
same
white
here.
Guilt and
yeah.
whatever it is. But like,
I bet you that's it.
I feel at home in a way,
uh-huh.
you know, sitting in a bar at 10 or 11 in the morning
yeah.
in a way that I don't in other places around, in a way that I often don't in places that other people are more comfortable.
Yeah. I tend to get more creeped out in the shiny,
yeah,
clean places.
Yeah.
And I actually went, you know, the laundromat next, a couple of doors down from the Drawing Room.
Uh-huh.
I used to go there, do my laundry and. One morning, I went in at like 9 or 10 in the morning to do my laundry. I was like, I've never been over there in the morning. I need to see what's going on.
Yeah.
And as you know, it has no window. So you walk in
yep.
and it feels like 2 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And there were exactly what you think. There were about 4 or 5 sad alcoholics. And then there were like 4 dudes up from the night before that, you know, stumbled in
right.
there,
yeah.
still drinking.
Absolutely.
And I loved it.
It's awesome. And incidentally, there's a great Italian restaurant called Pergoletta next door now that's awesome.
Oh, really?
But I remember I have my fondest drawing room memory is this would have been God, I don't know. If I were to guess, I'd probably say 2001, maybe. I was out drinking with a couple of buddies. And we'd gone to a party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is before cell phones. So we got split up. And I didn't know where they went. And I thought they'd ditch me. We got split up at like 2:33 in the morning. I think I was chasing some girl or something like that. And I got split up and I lost. And I was like, damn it, my buddies are gone. And I went home. And I went home and I like watched some TV. And like at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I crashed out, went to sleep. But my phone rang at like 10 after 6. So
a.m.
just like, 6 a.m., a couple of hours later. And I picked up my phone. And my friend was like, Judge, is my nickname is Judge. He's like, Judge, we're at the drawing room. Where are you? And I was like, all right, I'll be right there.
Yeah.
And I hung up the phone and I went right over there.
Oh, that's great.
I went and hung out. I was there at 6:30 and like.
And Jen, the bartender, I'm sure she worked there back then.
Yeah.
Do you remember Jen?
That's what being an actor and like, I'm sure. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I do. That's like there's a whole that gambling lifestyle and that actor's lifestyle definitely overlap in that like degenerate world where, you know, particularly actors who work just enough to make a living so they don't have to wait tables or have a day job.
Right.
But not enough that they're constantly working.
Yeah. So a lot of free time.
Which is what I've been for like 20 years. So like, it's a weird, weird life.
Yeah.
Particularly in Los Angeles, but man.
Yeah. And this movie just captures that. It's like, there's the scenes in the apartments of the ladies that they're taking up with. But other than that, it feels like every scene in that movie is a poker room, a boxing match, a horse track. Like they're everywhere where you can gamble.
Absolutely. And I got to make the disclaimer that as much as I love the movie, watching it this morning, I was watching with my fiance and the scene with Helen, who is a cross-dressing older man.
Yeah. Man, that was sad.
Who played by the great Burt Remsen. He's amazing in Thieves Like Us, which is the other one you need to see. But that scene felt a little dated to me in a way that that was the scene that I was like, I wonder if my fiance likes, you know, like it was the one that I'm wondering if Natasha thinks this is stupid.
Well, because the scene is,
it's a really sad scene, but it's played in like, it's the scene that I wish you could sort of retool.
Yeah, it's a man in drag.
Yeah,
who is clearly like fearful of the cops because it was a time where you could get busted for something like that.
Yeah,
and Elliot Gould and Siegel like pretend they're cops.
Yeah,
to be funny, and it's
right
again. Watching it today, I was like, oh man, that's fucked up.
Yeah, and sad. I think that its heart is in the right place, but it's played for laughs in a way that in 2018 I'm like kind of not quite as cool with, but whatever.
It's hard to judge a movie from 1974.
No, I know. I mean, everything.
Through today's lens.
You can't. I mean, everything would fall apart in that way, I think.
It's hard to judge a movie from 2004.
Yeah.
Much less 1974.
Yeah. Totally.
It looks so good, too. I didn't want to, like, let the cinematography get away because it's not flashy at all, but all those Altman movies from the 70s are just, and there's something about those films that just sort of washed out realness and that color was just I just eat it up.
Yeah.
And it looks so good today on like a nice flat screen TV and
I read it does. It actually the first several times I saw the movie, I saw it on a VHS tape that had been somebody had recorded it when it was like on cable.
Right.
Because you couldn't get it.
Yeah.
They didn't show it anywhere. And so that was the only copy I could get. And for several years I had that VHS tape and I, you know, cause I've seen the movie, you know, at least a good 10, 12 times now.
Uh-huh.
And so the first many times that I saw it. And the other thing that's funny about that is that the first like 60 seconds, 60 to 90 seconds were cut off the front of that, of that VHS.
Oh, wow.
So I never saw the very first minute or two until like my eighth or ninth viewing or whatever.
Well, and they had that explanation of poker at the very beginning too, which is kind of cool.
Well, it cut in the version that I had cut into that.
Right.
So anyway.
You didn't miss much, but
no,
sure.
I know I didn't miss much. It's so beautiful though.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it looks a lot like when you because you can get the you know the good high definition version on Amazon and it looks great.
Yeah,
I read that there was a more I forget who it is, but it's a name you'd know. But that there was a very like experienced, famous DP who was maybe going to do it, and Altman changed his mind at the last minute and went with somebody. He's like just worried that he was going to try to make it too pretty.
Oh yeah,
and he's like he wanted somebody. He probably just wanted somebody who could tell what to do a little bit more, you know.
Right.
But yeah, he wanted somebody who was sort of newer that was just going to be like just bare bones and
like overlight it or overdo it.
Yeah.
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 What is the California split? Because I know they split the money at the end. Is that what it is? I don't fully get that.
God, I feel like I looked this up and I can't remember now. I don't remember. I don't remember if it's an old gambling term or if it just sounds like an old gambling term. But it's something about, you know, he's his backer. He stakes him. So they split the money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I looked
that up one time and had the answer and I don't remember anymore.
But, I mean, these guys are not the same. I mean, like we said, George Siegel's character is desperate and has lost his wife because of this gambling problem. He's got a bookie on his tail.
Yeah.
And Elliot Gould, who's so, I mean, they're both great, but Elliot Gould is just so, like, he was peak Elliot Gould in the mid-70s.
I totally agree. I think...
so underrated, I think.
People ask me all the time who my inspirations are as an actor, and the big three for me are Buster Keaton, a guy named Eddie Bracken, who was in the Press and Sturges movies, Hail the Conquering Hero, and Miracle Morgan's Creek, who, like, another old-time guy who I just have stolen things from, and Gould. And, like, I love... these, like, Long Goodbye and California Split in particular, like, I love watching him work.
Yeah,
I just
man.
Love it, love it, love it.
So natural.
But this movie, to me, Siegel matched it. Like, I've never thought of George Siegel as an actor sort of in that caliber, but he kind of matches him perfectly here.
Yeah.
He gets set, like, you can tell by looking at his face that he knows he'll never be like that.
Yeah.
You know, he knows he can never be Charlie and that, like, there's so many things. It's like you bring up him losing his wife. I love that, you know, the only two mentions we have of his wife are there's one point when he goes to borrow money from a guy and he's like, oh, I'm getting this ESP that you're back with your old lady.
Right.
And then the second one is when he's with, the Gwen Wells character,
and he's great too.
She's great, also great in Nashville. And it's like a very depressing seduction scene.
Yeah,
and she's like, "You're married," and he says, "Yeah." Well, she says, "You're married." He says, "What does that matter?"
Uh-huh.
I'm separated, and that's it.
Yeah,
we don't. I love that we don't need, and part of this is how well Siegel plays it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need any more. We don't need him to give some monologue about what happened with him and his wife.
Right.
We don't need him to say at the end of the movie, I got to go try to make things right with my wife. We don't need any of that stuff. It's not necessary for the drama.
Mm-hmm.
The drama is mined by knowing that it's there and by then you feel it by watching it.
Yeah.
Like, I love that. And I just think nobody does that better than Altman, really.
Yeah. I mean, and he allows the actors, like, you never catch these guys acting or feeling like they're saying lines.
Yeah.
It's just so real.
Yeah.
And especially, I mean, they're both great, but Elliot Gould just blew me away.
He's so amazing.
I mean, he's so funny amazing. And like confident.
He's all over it. He's just like, and like, you know, his character does some things that are like, this guy's can be a little bit of a piece of shit sometimes.
Yeah, but, yeah, for sure.
But you're never mad at him. You know, you want to hang out with him.
Uh-huh.
And when the chips are down and he has to pull off something more, mm-hmm. he can do it. Like when he goes and gets his money back from the bully at the beginning and he beats him up in the bathroom and he says at the end, who's a funny man? And he's at the end of that scene, he's like, who's a funny man now?
Yeah.
Like that anger is there.
Yeah.
You know, it's all there.
That's such a great scene.
What a performance that is.
That's the best punch I've ever.
Yes.
Best punch I've ever.
Wow. What a punch. Yeah.
And then he kicks his ass and he's like, it wasn't one of your punches, but
yeah.
You know.
But I'll take it or whatever. Yeah,
but I'll take it.
Yeah.
And then he's like, is that over? And he starts kicking him. And
yeah, it's so cool.
I also love the scene where he comes back from Tijuana and George Segal's so pissed off at him.
That scene is amazing to me because he does the one-arm piccolo player.
Which is just hysterical.
It's so funny to watch. He's great at it, but it's another scene where Siegel's reaction to that when he falls out laughing.
That seemed very real.
I'm like, they had to film this where he really didn't know that was coming.
That had to have been the case. That was such a real moment. Or maybe not.
Maybe not. I to relate that to myself, I have this tiny little pet peeve. I don't mind it that much, but there's a scene in the first Guardians movie where Rooker's doing his babidi boobity boobity, you know, Galaga thing. And my character like cracks up behind him.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
And frequently I have fans come up to me and I don't hold it against them, but they're like, that had to be real.
Right.
You really were cracking up. And the actor inside of me wants to be like, no, I was acting there. That's my job.
Yeah.
You know, and it was actually a direction. It was like, we did it a few different ways.
Right.
And one of them was, you know, I'm going to crack up so that, yeah, it was a choice. I'm going to crack up like as though I'm surprised by it. And so I played it that way.
You sold it.
Well, thanks. But yeah, so I'm like, so I think back and I'm like, maybe Segal was just acting. But
yeah.
If he is, man, he does it beautifully because
I mean, big
that
time.
Looks like a real bust out laughter. I think it's probably, I don't think he's acting there. I think that he must have really not known what was coming there. But
yeah, and it brought real joy to him in that moment. Yeah, he's still around.
He's still around. I'd love to ask him.
It's so funny to look back at a time, and I talk about this a lot on the show, in the 70s where George Segal and Elliot Gould are leading men. Like, if this movie were made today, it would be, you know, Channing Tatum and Matt Damon.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like you could be Dustin Hoffman or George Segal in top line of movie.
Yeah.
Which is just crazy.
Yeah.
And great, you know.
I know. Those performances are so good. And they're ones I watch as an actor. I watch them over and over and over again. And I just like, I'm kind of in awe of them. It's everybody trusting everybody,
mm-hmm.
you know.
All right. So let's get to that ending. They go to Reno.
Yeah.
They go all in and pool their money. Which is always this, gambling movies give me a pit in my stomach. Like when people are putting all their money on the line.
Yeah.
I just like, this fucking makes me so nervous.
And this is a spoiler alert. So if you want to watch the movie,
for sure.
Pause at this point and watch it and then listen to the rest of it. But because, I expected, the first time I saw it, I fully expected George Segal to lose everything. And then,
me too.
And then learn some lesson.
Absolutely. And that's the way it feels like it should have gone.
But it's even better.
Yeah, they win.
He wins everything.
And he's still
And he learns an even harsher lesson, which is that it doesn't bring him anything. It doesn't make him happy.
It's such a sad scene. They win $82,000. And Elliot Gould, Charlie, is over the moon. And he's singing and laughing counting the money.
We're going to go out on the town.
They want to interview us.
Let's
celebrities.
Let's get suites at the hotel for a week.
Yeah.
Let's gamble every day. Live like kings.
Uh-huh.
You know? And it's my favorite. This is why this is the movie that I chose.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite moment, not just in films, but in like really just personally, just art in general, is that that scene starts with Charlie coming in and Bill is all still despondent. And Charlie's like, like, you know, wow, do you always take a big win this hard or whatever? Yeah. And Bill looks at him and he says, Charlie, there was never any special feeling. I just said there was.
Yeah.
And Charlie says, yeah, I know that. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
Okay. To me, that little exchange, that's it. That's the human experience for me in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Like that to me, I can apply that exchange to religion. I can apply it to you know, relationships. Mm-hmm. I can apply it to like anything about how people live their lives. Like that to me is a fundamental truth that I can't, it is just, that's what art to me is when it's working its best, is that that's an expression of a fundamental truth.
Yeah.
You know, that like, I, there wasn't any special feeling. I just said there was.
Yeah.
And which is already profound enough.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it is a little almost like religion. This is why I feel like the movie's like Waiting for Godot. It's like, it is a little bit like, you know, like religion or a relationship or whatever, you know, like when you fall in and out of love really quickly, or you convince yourself that your religion is saving you when it's not.
Right.
But then it's even better that Charlie responds like, no kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought we knew that, you know, and that's where they realize, oh, we're not alike at all.
Yeah.
You know, like
I feel like it's over after that. Like these guys are never going to see each other again.
Yeah. Charlie's like, I thought that was the truth that we all just sort of agreed to not talk about, but that we,
right.
Like, of course I'm pretending when I say I have a special magical feeling, you know? I don't know. It comes up for me. That moment comes up for me over and over and over again in my life.
Yeah. That's good stuff, man. It's such a just a gut punch of an ending.
It is. And then Elliot Gould is so good right after that, too. Because after that exchange, then he's still sitting there and he's despondent. And then that joker, you know, that funny man that we've seen the whole movie.
Oh, it's gone.
It just drops
out
of his face.
It was remarkable.
It's like one shot and it just drops.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, doesn't mean a fucking thing, does it?
Yeah.
And he knows. Like they, everybody gets it. It's like, it is like talk about the poetry of art. It's like, rather than having a guy lose everything and learn the lesson,
right,
you have them win everything and learn the lesson.
Yeah.
You know, like that's just fucking beautiful.
Yeah. So good. And only Altman would have been ballsy enough to, and shout out to, we talk about Altman a lot, but the screenwriter, what's his name?
Who's in the movie, you know, he plays Spike.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Joseph Walsh.
Yeah. He plays the bookie that George Siegel owes that he goes and meets and orders the chili.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What else has he written? Was he big time?
He was an actor, from what I understand, who like was, you know, not getting the roles he wanted and had that movie. I don't know much. I really don't know much else about him. I mean, I think my guess is that Altman and Elliot Gould took a lot of liberties on the script, I would think.
Probably so.
Yeah.
Such a great ending.
I don't know how much of that is in the movie, but yeah. But, and then the movie also has the prescience to end the movie when it's done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you have that scene and it's like, there's nothing more that needs to be said between them, and there's nothing more that needs to be said in the movie. It's like,
this is what we
came here for. Now we've learned it. Let's move on.
Yeah, and it's also one of those endings that makes you sort of rethink everything you had seen for the previous 2 hours.
Yeah.
And say, oh, like, it was there the whole time, this sadness and this, like, it's not the gambling. Like, these guys, it's not like, oh, they won the 82 grand, so now they're happy. And now they're satisfied.
Right.
Such a good movie.
Yeah.
Thank you for choosing this, because it would have slipped by me, probably.
I'm glad.
All right, we finished with a couple of quick segments. What Ebert said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
Nice.
And then five questions. Ebert gave this 4 stars. At the end of California Split, we realized that Altman has made a lot more than a comedy about gambling. He's taken us into an American nightmare, and all the people we met along the way felt genuine and looked real. This movie has a taste in its mouth like stale air conditioning, and no matter what time it seems to be, it's always 5 in the morning in a second-rate casino. It kind of nails it.
I like that. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
And then 5 questions with Sean Gunn. First movie you remember seeing in the theater.
Bed Knobs and Broomsticks.
Yeah.
I think.
I saw that.
Yeah. Would that be before Grease? That probably before Grease, right?
Yeah, I think so. They were pretty close, though, probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, I saw both those in the theater, too.
Yeah.
Those old Disney, those were fun movies. First R-rated movie you saw. Home or in the theater?
I got to see all that stuff earlier than anybody else.
As the youngest.
Yeah, as the youngest. I think it was, what year did Halloween come out?
I feel like that was like 79 or something.
Yeah, I think it was Halloween.
Wow. So you were.
Yeah. Yeah, I was little.
I was in there. Will you walk out of a bad movie?
Yeah.
And do you remember doing so?
Uh-huh.
And do you want to name it?
Oh, man. I've walked out of movies that people like. I remember walking out of Quiz Show.
Oh, interesting. That's a good movie.
I thought the first half of it was terrible, but I can't tell you. Like, gotcha. I don't know. I was, you know what? I also saw that movie when I was a very arrogant college student,
mm-hmm.
you know, who like was very, and I was like, yeah. And I think we also wanted to go do something else or whatever.
That happens
so I don't know if that quite counts. I bet I'd watch it now and say it's fine. What else have I've definitely walked out of other movies though. Not a lot, but I've done it.
All right. Let me see here. Number 4, I try to tailor to the guest. So what movie from the past do you most wish you could have been in? And you can name a role if you want, but you can also just say, I would have loved to have been in Raiders of the Lost Ark or whatever.
No, I think, you know what comes, like, can I give you 2?
Sure.
Because these are within my acting career, and they're movies that I think, man, this movie would have been better if I had played this role.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, let's hear
and
it.
The main one is, and I know he made it for no money and the guy like wrote the movie or whatever, but as low budget as it is, I felt like I should have been the lead in Pi, the Aronofsky movie.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a math guy too anyway. And it's just like, I remember watching
that
movie
totally see
and saying
that guy.
Like, God, this movie's really cool, but it would be so much better if this actor was more sort of on top of what he was doing here.
Yeah, that was sort of one of the...
Because he just doesn't seem like a professional. He seems
I could have seen you in that movie.
And the other one is a movie that I love, actually, anyway. But I remember seeing Wonder Boys and...
Love that movie.
I was right in the pocket where, like I was very jealous. I saw Tobey Maguire and I'm like, this guy's got a career and he's a movie star and I'm, like, struggling for commercial auditions or whatever, but, like, I'm like, he does a fine job.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I would have been perfect for that role.
Right.
That's
one of my favorite movies.
That movie's freaking great.
Yeah.
It really is I look forward to seeing that movie again. It's so good. And I really believe actually Tobey Maguire is good in that movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's one that like when I watched it, I'm like, yeah, that's one I would really
that's my role.
Yeah.
That's good. Great answers. And then finally, movie going 101. What's your movie routine when you go? Where do you sit? What do you eat?
I've gotten farther back. I don't care that much about eating when I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, you know, I see movies by myself a lot less than I used to. So like if when I'm with my fiance, she's a popcorn person, so uh-huh. I'll eat popcorn. You know. But I don't really care that much about eating. I prefer to go to a movie that's not going to be too packed. I will take not sitting next to people over location. Like, I'd rather not have people on
so
either side.
So further back
of me.
If you can get away from
yeah,
people.
Yeah, and also as I've gotten older, I don't mind. I mean, and also as movie theaters have gotten better, I don't mind a little further back. I'd say I'm generally like about 2/3 of the way back.
Okay.
Towards one or the other of the sides, but then adjusting that for like an island of safety where there's not too many people.
Or
there's not too many people around. And I see so many, like, I bet I haven't seen 3 movies in the theater this year.
I don't get out as much as I used to, for sure. That just happens.
But I hear Mandy's really good, and I heard...
I've heard that, too.
And my buddy said, go see A Star Is Born, so I'm going to go see it.
I want to see that, too.
Yeah.
Your buddy, the raccoon.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, good stuff, man. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
This
appreciate
was a lot of fun.
It. This is great.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that. That was a fun talk. Afterward, Sean's very sweet. He was like, I hope that I wasn't long-winded. How long do these normally go? And I'm like, dude, they go as long as they go. And if they're long ones, then that's a good sign that it's a good one. Because that means that we were having a good human conversation eye to eye with no cell phones in front of our faces, which was great. And really enjoyed his insight on California Split. A lot of things I didn't think about that he sort of opened my eyes to with this movie. And our shared love of Elliot Gould was apparent. So now we're Elliot Gould bros and George Segal bros. Great film. I'm glad he turned me on to it. I got a couple of more holes to fill in my Altman slate. Thanks to Sean telling me about those movies. So I can't wait to watch those. And I might have him in here again, folks. He and I got along so well, and he's in the area. And I'm definitely going to get his lovely fiance, Natasha, on. And we're going to talk about movies, too. So look forward to that. And hope you enjoyed it. You can follow Sean on Twitter, if you're into that, at Sean Gunn, SeanGunn. The Judge, apparently. What a great nickname. So thanks to Sean for coming in, and we will see you next week on Movie Crush, everyone. And until then, why don't you go binge watch The Gilmore Girls? It's a lot of fun. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.